This week in Retronauts, the Dark Souls of video game collecting.
Is that what this was about?
Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't made a Dark Souls metaphor on Retronauts before, so
that's pretty good. Yeah.
So I think I'm allowed one, considering how often Bob brings up Dark Souls. I think that's okay.
I think Dark Souls is more prototype stuff.
It could be. So what would this be? Well, we can figure it out. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and if it sounds a little wonky, or if it sounds amazing, I don't know what's going to happen with the audio quality on this one, but I'm recording in a hotel room in Santa Clara because it's California Extreme, and I'm here with a bunch of guys who are at California Extreme, but also have a lot to say about this week's topic, which is collecting video game ephemera. Which is a very kind of vague and nebulous topic title. But basically, you know, we've talked about game collecting. We've talked about sort of presenting games in the best possible way, you know, finding the right technology for that. We've talked about game preservation. And this is kind of the next step in that, which is collecting, preserving things that aren't actually games, but are related to the games. Because in a way, that stuff's extremely valuable. And provides really great insights into the past and into the marketing and sales and distribution and timing of video games. But it's not something that people really make a collection of very often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll see someone who's like, oh yeah, I want to have, you know, all the marquees for the versus Nintendo systems. Or, you know, I want like point of sale posters for all the Nintendo Famicom Disk System games or something. But things like marketing materials, internal documents, like, where do you find that stuff? What value does it have? What value can you put on it? Who do you get it from? Like, it's, you know, it's just this really vague and poorly defined area of video game history, but one that I think deserves curation and discovery. And so the guys I'm talking to today are very much about that. So why don't we just introduce ourselves counterclockwise style?
So I'm Frank Cifaldi. I've been on the show a couple times, and I am the head of restoration at Digital Eclipse, and a video game, I guess, archivist and historian is what I call myself, right? Is that what's on my Twitter bio?
I think
archivist
so. Something like that.
Archivist and historian? Yeah, that sounds great.
Good.
Yeah, it does sound great, right?
It fits. It's apt.
So the thing is, the thing about being a video game historian, how do you do it? You just put it on your Twitter bio.
That's what I did.
I got to do that, too. I totally neglected that. Next.
Oh, so I'm Mike Micah. By day, I'm a game developer. I work on games for everything out there. But by night, I'm also a game preservationist and game historian by hobby, basically. But I work with Frank a lot on a lot of this stuff. Whenever I can, I'm kind of following his lead. Like, oh, that's what we should do, shouldn't we, Frank?
And, well, for both jobs, right?
Yeah, exactly. For both jobs.
Yeah.
But I've been collecting game ephemera for as long as I can remember because I always thought of that as the most disposable thing out there. There's no checklist for it.
Right.
So I'm like, I would always worry about that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's where my focus has mostly been.
And ephemera by definition is
disposable.
It's
disposable.
It's ephemeral.
So it's exactly. So it's just every time I see somebody getting rid of something or talking about, oh, I don't know what to do with this, should I just toss it? It's like, no, just treat my house as a garbage can.
And you've been doing that since like the 90s.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Steve Lin. I'm head of platform for Got It, former game developer, also archivist and historian. I've been collecting since, well, I never got rid of anything from a kid, as a kid. So especially past couple years, maybe decade or so, been really strong. And then I've also been on Retronauts before, Pac-Man and Atari Lynx.
Yeah, even a few times, yeah.
Have you been?
No, you know what? I'm trying to remember. I don't think I have. There was a moment where I may have been briefly on one, but I vaguely remember.
Huh. Walk past your podcast. Sucks.
Yeah, but it's like back in the day. Exactly. I think that's what it was.
Right.
Well, I'm glad we could finally get you on, and I'm glad we can get all of you guys on because this is an area that I find interesting, but have no skin in the game. I'm very much a person who likes stuff, but doesn't want a lot of it. And by definition, this is just unruly. It's chaos, and that's kind of like, well, no, I've seen like photographs of your place, Frank.
Yeah.
It's very tidy.
Yeah.
But still, like, there's a lot of boxes and stuff.
Well, paper is very compact.
product.
It is.
It's also very heavy.
Yes.
It is. Yeah. When I moved across the country, like, we almost got in trouble because we had so many books that it was like twice as heavy as one of those storage cubicles is supposed to be. It was like 5,000 pounds instead of 2,500. So they scolded us about that. So, like, I just know I should not get involved in this because I tend to have kind of a I wouldn't say obsessive personality, but once I start on something, I'm like, I got to keep doing this. I got to go all the way with it.
And this is endless.
Like, this would be...
Oh, it's literally endless. There's no checklist.
I can't even imagine. Exactly. Like, it would drive me crazy. And I don't have time or energy for that, or money. So you guys keep doing the hard work. And my work as a video game historian will be making a podcast where I talk to people who do actual hard work.
Well, you also do what we do. With Game Boy World.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I get that stuff and then pass it along, or I borrow it.
Well, that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah, we're kind of in that.
The problem is that with the stuff that we focus on, there's not really in a place that they go after.
Right.
Yet, you know, that's...
Yeah. Well, and also I was able, like, through, you know, a lot of research and checking Japanese wikis and stuff to be able to put together, like, a very firm, rigid checklist and timeline. So... I can just kind of follow those rules and not have to worry about, like, what else is out there.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, that's kind of our problem, right? Like, it's every day I'm always finding out something that, like, needs to be preserved, and it's like, damn it. Like, it's too big. Where are we supposed to put that or whatever? You just don't know. It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, so just to get started, I guess the question is, you know, what do we mean by video game ephemera? I kind of gave sort of, like, a high-level view, but I'd be curious to hear what you guys specifically say and, you know... More to the point, like, what you are specifically interested in. I assume it's not just, like, everything indiscriminately. I mean, maybe it is, but I feel like, you know, within this, there's still, like, a tendency to specialize or to seek out specific things.
Yeah. So I guess, really, the topic just covers anything that isn't a consumer product.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think that's a pretty blanket statement, but I think it works for what you'd consider video game
ephemera.
That's
at the top, and then everything branches out.
Right. So, like, anything that, you know, was sent to the media is video game ephemera. Like, any promotional or sales material, any internal documentation, any internal anything.
Right.
Right? I mean, I don't know, by our definition, maybe a prototype cartridge is ephemeral, right?
But I think that's kind of a different... That does count. Like, source code would count.
Yeah, source code, absolutely.
Documentation, game developer documentation.
Yeah. You know, like, flyers that you get at trade shows if you were a buyer. Like Ian in our office, Ian, who was a programmer on Mega Man Legacy Collection, actually the 3DS version, he was the lead. His dad was a buyer for a store. I don't remember which store, but because of that, like, Konami and Jalico and all these other companies would send him VHS tapes with previews of the games and carts. But, like, those tapes, those sales tapes are what I'd consider video game ephemera, right? And, you know, I don't know. I guess what I specialize in, I'm thankful that I'm not someone that has a tendency to grab everything because, like, I would drive myself crazy. But, like, I have a filter of myself. I don't know where that filter starts and ends, but I think I have an instinctual filter that's like, this has information that might be useful to someone someday, or has, like, better art than is on the box, you know, like, and that's sort of where I focus. A lot of my, like, personal collection over the years, I don't know if I've ever even talked about the magazines on this show, but I collect video game magazines, and my focus is North American, because that's, you know, because shipping's crazy. Mm-hmm. Basically, North American game focused, like, game specific, so not like PC general with game coverage, but game specific magazines, from post crash through the end of the 90s. Because, and you know, I kind of cut myself off there in my personal collection because IGN and GameSpot are still online and still have their news archives online, and, like, archive team has probably scraped that stuff. So to me, like, the news stuff is probably mostly online, whereas anything from 99 and before, for the most part, is not. So that's where a lot of my stuff stops. But that's just the paper, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I've got Jeremy, when we moved offices at 1UP, I took you probably remember, I took all of the electronic press kits that were around and all the old builds and stuff.
Because no one wanted those.
Right. And like,
this is the steal from work. Right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it wasn't even, is it theft if it's just going to be thrown out?
Like, right.
Like no one really cared about that. It was just stacks of old CD-ROMs and zip disks.
Yeah.
Like no one even has zip disks, zip drives anymore.
Well, it's technically theft because it's company property.
Yeah.
You know, did anyone, did Sam actually sign off?
It's actually
off,
like thrown out, right? Once it hits the sidewalk.
Well,
right,
it wasn't on the sidewalk.
Yeah,
it was
okay, all right.
En route.
This was en route to the sidewalk.
There was the pile. There was the going to the trash pile.
Yeah. Right. that's close enough. You were carrying it to the trash and you just went to your car instead.
Even if it wasn't going to be thrown out at that point, I can guarantee that it would have been thrown out.
It would have been thrown out, absolutely. But like those press kits are, and you know, sorry, like there's so many subjects that can go down here, and I'll try to wrap this up because we're kind of going around the room. But like the press kits, you know, extremely valuable from an historical perspective because these press kits tend to have really high resolution, art from those games that doesn't exist or, you know, maybe exists in the IGN gallery for the game, shrunk down to like 10% of its original size,
JPEG compressed, modem.
And JPEG compressed with an IGN watermark, you know what I mean? Like, that's the only way to see that art right now. Or, like, you know, those the zip discs, and, like, there were 5 Magneto optical discs, if anyone remembers that format, from,
like
old
Bernoulli
EGM.
Or something?
What's that?
Like a Bernoulli disc?
I don't even know what that word means. But, like, Sony-branded Magneto optical, like, one of them I got from 1UP was Space World 97's screenshots that Nintendo sent out. So
that would have had like Pokemon stuff.
Yeah,
and,
10 screenshots of Mother 3.
Mother 3, yeah.
Like direct capture screenshots of Mother 3.
Stuff.
Yeah, headed for the trash, you know? So
probably pre Game Boy Color, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some really good stuff. Like there's a, you know, like it was still called Zelda 64. Or maybe that was a different disc. I think I have a disc that's just called Zelda 64. Anyway, that's kind of where I focus in most of my collecting stuff, and anything that talks about an unshipped game, I tend to grab.
Yeah,
just because like, you know, that stuff is the most ephemeral of the ephemera.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you know, any documentation on that game tends to not exist.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of a good segue because that's where a lot of my ephemera collection started, was in the mid '90s, early '90s, when I first started going to trade shows, and I was just fascinated by even the look of press kits. Because I remember the Donkey Kong Country press kit was in this green forest box that had like Velcro. You open it up and everything inside was really nice and high production value. And so I kept all that stuff when other people just kind of pull out what they wanted and throw everything away.
Right.
But my focus primarily is actually on the ephemera surrounding game development and the creation process of games. Because I'm really fascinated about the people involved in games and how they came up with the game ideas and all that stuff. So I have stuff that's like game design documents, artwork from game development process. Like the one thing that a good friend of ours, Brett Pulliam, gave me was a from a Congo Bongo design kit that was like the original design documentation that had artwork done to kind of illustrate what the game would look like and how it would play and stuff, and typewritten on the back is like what each level would be like and things like that. And I love stuff like that. I've got
Is that the original or are those copies?
It's an original.
Wow.
And there was, I think Brett found it at like either California Extreme or one of these kind of
California
shows.
California Extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like in a bin. I know.
It's those bins. So, I mean, we'll get into this in a second. But
yeah,
a lot of these, you know, arcade operators or you know, production companies will just dump off into ops and then it shows up in a plastic tub that you need to dig through at California Extreme.
It's amazing to me. So I focus a lot on that. I have things like clay characters from like the Neverhood games and stuff like that, or even
like the actual figurines.
Actual figurines from the set of the thing. And I don't even think a lot of those guys still have those. And I would just ask them for that stuff when they're building it. Even down to like stuff like McFarlane Toys did the Metal Gear figures.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I had an opportunity where they're getting rid of stuff and they're getting ready to toss the Psycho Mantis original sculpt that they use to design the character and then 3D scan and then do whatever. I'm like, why would you toss that out? So I have like that sitting down there and stuff like that. So things like that. And also I'm interested in the business aspects of like what led to companies forming and this sort of thing. So I have a collection of fax exchanges and all this stuff because it's interesting to me to follow that story and have that history and connect the dots between how Will Wright went from like Radio on Bungling Bay to creating a company, Maxis, around SimCity and what was Micropolis before and all this stuff. And then having all the source code and all the stuff around it so you can really tell the tale and see how like some of the biggest games in our our field and industry here were formed and created from simple ideas or just mistakes or accidental business ventures.
And you kept some really, like, sort of unrelated to that stuff, but you kept some interesting ephemera, like that Big Lots flyer. I just saw at your house.
Yeah.
It's great. Like, you kept a Big Lots flyer from when they were closing out the Atari inventory that they bought. So, you know, this is like, you know, NES era, like...
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s,
right,
probably.
But it was
literally
like,
games advertised for a dollar.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
These games are a dollar, these are $2, and these are $3.
And I run into people all the time. Like, even back then, it was so amazing to me because it blew my mind that this was even happening. Because to me, that was like heaven. Like, being able to go and buy an Atari, a full system for $24, a 7800, and then buy every game I wanted for
$1. System was 4 years old at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
It was mind-blowing. So, like, it was such an impact that I kept the flyer for years, and I knew I had it somewhere, and I was digging through stuff.
Yeah.
I posted that flyer on Twitter. I took a picture and put it on Twitter. It's one of my like most shared and largest impression tweets I've ever put out, which it blows my mind. But shows that stuff, if I had not kept that, like how many people were interested in that? People around the country knew that.
Yeah, maybe there's a Big Lots flyer collector somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. But that may only be the one last flyer out there.
And Steve, you have clay figures too.
I do have clay figures. So in terms of my ephemera, I focus a lot on Nintendo. And originally, for me, it was all the merchandising material. So like the kiosks. So I have all of the kiosks that Nintendo... at least the playable kiosks. And
right.
then I've recently started adding the ones that are non-playable. It's just for display purposes only. It's like the M3, which was replaced by the M83 or 93. And then I actually got into collecting paper through Frank. So I had always gotten like CES and E3 flyers.
I didn't know this. Actually.
Stuff like, you know, I went to the first E3 and so I had like all the Polygon Man. I'm like, oh, they got rid of this and you know, all that stuff. But then the more I talked to Frank about magazines and paper, I started realizing how much I was exposed to it in just overall collecting. And then instead of, you know, just looking through games and prototypes, I would look through these, you know, banker's boxes. And like, okay, what's in here? And a lot of my personal collection is focused on early stage Nintendo. So this is early to mid 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nintendo NES release press release, things like the games used in the Magnavox via Nintendo trial, and then to what Frank mentioned earlier, I have the original clay figures, Tetris figures that were used in that issue of Nintendo Power.
That's awesome.
And so it's those models that they use in the photograph.
Which you bought from Howard Phillips, right?
Yes, they got from Howard Phillips. So
who kept his clay Tetris representation of himself, which
yes,
I think is
yes.
Do you remember that issue? It was Howard and Phillips
as
Tetris figures.
Yes.
Yeah. Howard and Nestor.
Howard and Nestor. And yeah, so a lot of that internal company newsletters where they talk about shipping out all those Dragon Warrior copies and things like that. So that's really been my focus, but now it's, I'll look through anything and we can get into this, but part of it is just realizing, all right, what's important and what's not.
Yeah.
And a lot of that just requires that breadth of knowledge. You have to be like, is this important or not? And you just sort of, well, this is probably close. And then you filter down after that.
And we can never, I mean, I say this all the time. We can't know what's going to be important, like even
right.
5 years from now. Right. But you know, I think, to not drive ourselves crazy, you have to have some kind of internal filter, right?
Yeah, there's times when you're just walking through a show and you're like, this is, no,
I can't
do this. This is
just
like,
walk away. Yeah.
There's 20 like little motion activator controls and like one of these, no, I don't even care. Like, I can't do it.
Yeah. So that's where we focus.
Yeah.
Maybe this is kind of an obvious question or has an obvious answer, but why is this stuff valuable?
I mean, to me, you know, I get interviewed about video game preservation kind of often. You were the first person to ever interview me about that, actually. the first Retronauts I was on in like 2006 or something. But to me, preserving a video game, like, I think most people just think of that as the binary code that makes up the game. Like, is that binary code reproduced one for one? Yes, that game's preserved. Mm. I don't agree with that. I think a game is more than just the code. I think we'd all agree with that. I think a game is the story that surrounds it, the development that went into it. Like, you know, you talk about source code, which is like the rarest of the rare, but like comments in source code can tell you so much.
You see
about
the DNA of a game. Like we found Goof Troop source code in Resident Evil.
Yeah.
And then you realize that's a Mikami game, right? Yeah. And like all these things where it's like you see the DNA of how this evolved into something else and where the origins of these games come from.
And you know, it tells you a lot just about the nature of game development in a time and a place. I mean, like, you're still kind of using Game Boy code once in a while. Like in iDarb and stuff,
exactly.
Right?
really.
But like the marketing of a game to me is a huge part of that game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the product that the developer made, it's the marketing team. But to me, like, that whole thing is a package.
Right.
And like, I think part of that honestly started from my own nostalgia. Like I kind of realized that I might be more nostalgic for game marketing than for games sometimes. You know, like, I'm more nostalgic for Nintendo Power than I am for most Nintendo games, you know? Or like, you know, I was a Sega Genesis kid because their stupid marketing really got to me. You know? So like, video game marketing was such a huge important part of the culture, and I think preserving that's really important. And
well, I think it's like understanding the environment in which these games existed, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of times, like, oh, I can put in Sonic the Hedgehog, but then you like through marketing material, videos and print ads and everything like that, you can actually realize, all right, this is why, you know, Nintendo made Play It Loud, right?
Yeah.
Or like all these weird Game Boy colors and like, you know, Rorschach test like ad campaign. So I think that it puts things into context that is lost when you're just playing the game.
Yeah.
But even through, I mean, you see as a game was being developed, it was also influenced by marketing and the reactions that the market was getting too. There's, we've seen early versions of games and looked through source on some things, which I can't really mention some of these games because like they should never, if they were what they were at that point in time before marketing put it out there, they would never have shipped that because there was some awful stuff in there that had to change for it to actually become a shippable product.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that games up until probably the final stretch are most often very terrible, and they're trying to fix them all the way to the last point, and then something magical happens, and it turns into a good game. But a lot of it's influenced by the reaction they get from the marketing of the game and what people are reacting to and once they realize what the game is and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So one thing, I mean, along with the paper is the stories. And so if you want to talk about ephemera, you almost
people are ephemeral.
Yeah, people,
exactly.
Right? And it's getting, you know, everyone, well, not everyone, but a lot of people who were there in the early days of the formation of this industry are still alive and, you know, still able to tell stories. And
but that's the clock we're racing against because now we're trying to talk to all these people and find out how these things went down and stuff. Because a lot, they're not used to being talked to about this stuff.
Yeah.
And they're also, you know, they're getting older. This young industry is not young anymore.
Right. Well, the, you know, the paper, I think what it can do is help guide the questions that you want to ask the individual, right? So you can be like, okay, I read about this prototype, and then you ask the programmer, like, do you remember that?
Or like, you know, if it's an unshipped game or something, right?
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, times, unless they like were working on it every day, like people don't remember it. Like someone in sales like, oh, I kind of remember Bashy Bazook, you know what I mean? But like, if you have all this ephemera and material, and you can sort of paint a picture of like for example, I hope I, so far anyway on eBay, I'm the only person who collects CES show guides. And what's really interesting about those is that they'll have often for each company, they'll have a list of brands or products they're promoting at that show. And they'll also have the names of people who are like the contacts for that company, which is extremely valuable because that's better than LinkedIn. But like, If you get someone and sit them down for oral history and you can sort of paint a picture of like what was going on in the company that year, that's going to start unlocking memories for them, right? It's
right.
Like, oh yeah, we were pushing Bases Loaded 2 that year. So, oh right, Bashy Bazook was that weird. You know what I mean? And then, and I'm just like, that's, I have not interviewed anyone about Bashy Bazook more for Basher, but yeah, it's just the first unreleased game to come to mind or whatever. But like,
but it fills in gaps. Like, there's a lot of, you'll see games that were announced with code names, and so you can only guess at what those games could have been. But then when you start following the paper trail, you realize they're probably just porting this other game. They didn't want people to know they were going to release it as that.
Yeah.
So they put out a fake name or whatever, but they were like queuing up their plan.
Yeah.
And the only way they could publicly put it out there was to fake a name, put it out, and do that. But also, a lot of game developers who worked on these games from a long time ago, their names were obfuscated from the development journals. So it's like using this paper trail too, you start to piece together who actually worked on the game. You could tell that this person worked on a game with this person before because you've got all the paperwork, and you kind of do the old like movie thing where you're looking through microfiche. All this paperwork's like that, where you're connecting the dots, and you finally draw a line to like this person had to be the person who worked on this game.
Yeah,
you make the cold call, and if you're lucky, that is you've nailed it because you had all the evidence.
Or like, you know, something I often do, and this is leading to some kind of project someday, is get as much info as I can about the unshipped games for the NES, and we've talked about how. You know, why I find that so interesting. And like, just here's an example of something I just learned recently through Ephemera. So Kung Fu 2 was announced for the NES twice. The first time was in 1987, and the second time was in 1992. That 1992 version was a localization of Spartan X2, mm-hmm. the Famicom game. But did they announce that same game 5 years before? No, it was a different Kung Fu 2, which I always suspected. But it wasn't until I went to Frisco, Texas, and spent 4 days in the National Video Game Museum's paper archive going through flyers that I found a flyer from 1987 it's Irem, right? Mm-hmm. Irem, yeah. That had a little thumbnail image of Kung Fu 2. And it was, you know, the Kung Fu dude with, like, this blue vest on. Like, not vest, but, like, tank top. Over like white clothes, and it's like, oh, this is like
vigilante.
It's almost vigilante. Yeah. Like, it's like, but it's not quite.
Yeah.
It is in fact a local a port of Kung Fu 2, which is an unreleased arcade game that was only discovered last year as a board. I don't know if you've even
seen that.
You have seen it, yeah. So it's like, oh, it's like, you know, painting that picture. It's like, okay, that game didn't come out. Because the arcade game didn't come out.
Yep.
So, you know, there's... So just digging up all this paperwork and just stuff that people tossed. I mean, that was like, you know, you're a buyer for Toys R Us at CES and people are just handing you their garbage. You know, it's like advertising the games and most people just tossed them.
Yeah.
But that whole, like, the name, the same name, Kung Fu 2, but two different games sort of in the process there. I mean, we ran into that when we were at a talk with the LucasArts guys.
Yeah.
And we went and we were talking to Eric Wilmunder, who were just asking if he had any old, really old canceled games or things they ever worked on, which led to him saying he had an old hard drive for his Atari 800.
Right.
When he was working on stuff for Atari, even.
Yeah.
And so that led to us finding and him telling us that he did, but he never thought to do anything with it. It was Star Raiders 2.
Right.
Which at first, a lot of people were like, well, that came out. But it's the actual real Star Raiders 2.
Yeah.
The one that came out was just like, was it Last Starfighter? And renamed. But he worked on the true sequel, which is amazing. Even by today's standards, it was mind-blowing technically. And so that was able to come back really out good. Through just a small conversation. If we didn't think about Star Raiders 2 and just think to ask even deeper questions...
Yeah.
That would have just sat on a hard drive and maybe died off and rotted away.
Yeah.
Had we not pushed really hard. So those kind of things are, you got to really think on your feet.
And it's finally online now because someone else did it because we're too busy.
Yeah, we're too lazy to get it there. We did dump it.
It's not lazy.
Yeah, we did
dump
it. We dumped
it for them, but somebody did a nice story and got it out there. It was awesome. Yeah.
And speaking as someone who doesn't, you know, do all of this, you know, hunting for ephemera, like the work that you do is really valuable. Like the Kung Fu 2 thing, you stumbled across that and posted about it on Twitter like a week before I did a video history on Kung Fu.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, that's great. Here's a little bit of trivia I can add to the video.
Well,
so
even the show,
it was fantastic.
Like the links that we go, like was it last year at California Extreme or maybe a year before, like all three of us and a few other people with Brett.
Oh, yeah, the Atari.
We heard the Atari building was being demolished, right. where they developed E.T. and this sort of thing. So we drove from the show over there. And one of our friends climbed under the fence and went and grabbed a whole bunch of pieces of the building for us because they're like, we got to have pieces of this building because they're getting ready to haul it all away.
So. Yeah, so they had said, like, they're demolishing the building. And, like, we have to get over there. And it had already been demolished, but there was the sort of detritus around. And there's a security fence. We're like, this isn't going to stop us from this. And so, like, we have this, like, chunks of the Atari building. And it's that's a weird piece of ephemera. It's like, why do you have this piece of concrete, like, sitting on your shelf? It's like, that's a part of the
Atari
building.
For the same reason that you have an E.T. card that literally smells like poop.
Because I went out there at Alamogordo and we dug that up for that documentary. In fact,
I didn't even think about how that would smell, but
it is the worst smelling thing. So no Ziploc can hold that smell. So it's like I've got three layers of Ziploc over this thing in a box, taped, and then that in a bag, and it still reeks. It's that bad. That's
metaphor
how awful.
For the game itself.
Yes. But it's one of those things where, like, as a result though, there's so many people want a piece of that building who worked there and stuff. So I've been chipping away. It's like big thing I have that we've pulled out, and I'm like chipping this off to give out
next
like,
to it.
Howard awesome. Needs this, and this guy that worked in the building who was in the warehouse wants one.
Yeah.
Well, as we talk about, like, there's no checklist, but what's interesting is actually I worked in a video game trade-in shop in the early 90s. This is NES to Super Nintendo era, and that list of the games that we would take in for trade was my checklist, because things like Mike Edler's list really hadn't gotten out there. It was more people trading things over like postal mail. And then there, Funko Land and all these other places started listing games that would show up, in sales brochures. And those are maybe things that we can start looking for, right? Okay, did that really exist, or was that point? Is that the code name for something that came out later?
Or like, if you go on Google Groups and search old news groups posts, you will find like NES lists that have fun chip games in them, because people didn't know, because they're just looking at like mail order lists and being like, that's.
We were at one show, I forgot what the gentleman's name was, but he ran one of the back catalog, old early day Atari era magazine back catalog lists. I think it was Video Livery or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was always fascinated as a kid. I'm looking at games like Foxbat and all this stuff. And I'm like, I can't find anything on this online or anything like that. And then he finally disclosed to me. He's like, oh, we just made up stuff because we just wanted to get people excited to keep looking and waiting to see if the game's coming out, because like they knew stuff was coming. So they just make up names and then swap them out when new games actually were real. So I'm like, damn it. Like, I've been looking for 20 years for Foxbat materials and you just like made it up one.
Or like I have an example of that, which is, I maintain a database of the unshipped NES games. And one of the fields that I try to keep tabs on is, do we have a primary source that this actually existed, or is this like maybe just a rumor? And so there was one game that was just on mail order lists called Baby Gangster for the NES, which is a great title.
Like I'd buy that.
Right. It sounds, my immediate assumption is unlicensed, crappy, whatever, or just made up.
Yeah.
Right. Like another Beebus Eye or something, Baby Gangster. But then, I went through, and this is also from the collection of the National Video Game Museum, actually. I went through, there was a binder that Nintendo sent to customs, to U.S. Customs, and part of it, and it was to help stop counterfeit material from getting into the country, and part of it was a list of third-party licensees and their titles, and under Vic Tokai was Baby Gangster.
Like primary source confirmation.
So I now have a primary source.
So like SD Golgo 13.
No, that wasn't in there. But there's some weird stuff.
No, that could have been.
Oh, it could have been. Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
It's like the crib silhouette and two babies. Like,
one of them like trips on the way. Yeah, but like another one on that list that there's no source of anywhere else is Karnov 2. Is listed on this thing that. So at Nintendo at some point, Data East told them we're making Karnov 2, and it went on a list. I think it even has a product code and stuff. But like, that's again piecing together that's like one piece of paper and then another one that like combined, tells us okay, there really was at least on a piece of paper somewhere from Vic Tokai.
There was intent.
Like even if they never made a game, they had intention, or at least published intention somewhere, making a game called Baby Gangster. So if and when I talk to people at Vic Tokai, I know to ask them about Baby Gangster.
And it's funny because they remember it, right?
Yeah. Actually, the one guy I talked to did not. He's like, what the hell's that?
It could have been just like the method too, because we knew they would have to lock in with Nintendo that they're going to have X amount of products that year.
Right.
They would like have to, sometimes they didn't have anything in mind.
Placeholder titles.
Yeah, we're going to have a sequel to one of our hits so Nintendo doesn't give them our slot.
Or Vic Tokai in Japan actually made a weird game called Baby Gangster.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Never know.
Or like, what you were saying is like even the mail order people would make up titles that they would assume exist. Or like, I think Vic Tokai actually in particular like announced a lot of stuff that didn't even start. Because I think a lot of times at CES, you would announce a title and like a description for a game that you hadn't even begun developing yet just to see if there was buyer interest.
Exactly. If buyers are like, okay, we want that.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. And then you get your orders and then you're like, okay, we can now raise money.
They ordered the game. We better make it.
Yeah,
right.
We can now like say we got that money guaranteed, get a loan from the bank and make the game.
Yeah. So I had that conversation with Howard Phillips when he talked about like where to track some of this stuff down. He's like, look at those third-party developers because they were the ones hustling, right? They're like, we want to find a hit game. We want to get some of this funded. So they're just pitching everything.
Yeah.
And maybe at CES, they're like, hey, Baby Gangster, Baby Gangster. And then all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, where's this Baby Gangster game?
Babies are big right now. Yeah. Gangsters are big right now.
Dick Tracy.
Yeah, did you see Dick Tracy? Dick Tracy with babies.
Right. So I think there's a lot of that, and how much of it is sort of first party confirmation or primary source right. confirmation. And that's why I focus a lot on Nintendo paper. Because this is from the company. It's, you know, printed there. It's at least something was communicated there.
I think we all agree that the NES unshipped library is really fascinating.
It is.
And because again, and maybe we've talked about this on the show, I don't remember, but you know, the NES was such a weird case where everyone was making so much money that they could afford to just throw everything at the wall and see what stuck. And with the licensee restriction, of course, they could only release 5 games a year. So there were a lot of games that were completed and were fine or good or maybe even great. Some of them, I don't know, not yet.
Haven't found those yet.
Right. But like, you know, like really like decent games. They weren't like canceled midway through development because they weren't working or anything. These were like actual NES games that, you know, if the butterfly flapped like a second later, you know, could have actually come out.
And yeah, because of that restriction of how many titles it could release a year actually shelved a lot of games. And because, like you said, they were making a lot of money, so they were developing all kinds of games at once.
Like, Capcom might make 10 games that year and then ship the 5.
Yeah, and we have reason to suspect that Capcom has a lot of really great NES completed games that are just sitting dormant somewhere if they still exist.
Yeah.
And just because of that process, they were a company that would develop these games and then decide what they could ship and what they should ship in what year.
And yes, we have asked.
Yes, we definitely have asked. Yes.
In our relationship.
And that's how we have the clues we have. Yeah. We haven't got confirmation yet.
But yeah, I mean, like, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I mean, this kind of gets into my next question, which is, how do you even know what to look for? I mean, obviously, you know, things that are of personal interest to you, like the NES unreleased library, that's a good starting point. But for a lot of these other things, like, who would think to look for, you know, like you mentioned, you know, the Star Raider 2 source code or things like legal documents for court cases. Like, what makes you start to stop and think, oh, you know what would be really interesting is, you know, Exhibit A from the Magnavox.
Well, I think Magnavox in both of these cases, like, we lucked into that stuff.
Yeah,
right?
That was total luck for me. I mean, it was, how did I even do that? So
that was that French auction, right?
Yeah, but it was before that. So what happened was there was an eBay auction. So this is specifically the Magnavox versus Nintendo trial stuff ephemera that I got.
Yeah, we didn't go through. We didn't go to a court and dig through.
Yeah, right. And through court documents. Yeah. So I guess what happened was there was an eBay auction for I think like an Excitebike or something that had the Magnavox v Nintendo sticker on it, and everyone's like, "That's weird. Like, where did that come from?" And then realizing what that was, and it went for I think $10,000 or something crazy. Yeah, because it was a couple carts. It's the black box carts I don't own from the trial was that first batch, and then I started doing research and realizing that there was an auction in Paris where there was a collector who had accumulated a lot of this from Ralph Baer and was selling it off, and so I was doing telephone bidding for these, and I just obliterated anyone who was trying to bid on that. But what came along with it was not just the games, but a lot of pieces of paper. So it's Ralph Baer's testimony on why Nintendo infringes on Sanders Associates patents. And it's like hand-drawn, you know, diagrams and everything else. And that was kind of a bonus, right? It just kind of, it came in there, and then we were able to piece more together. Like, you know, on Christmas Day, and I think it's like 1985, like, I know what Ralph Baer was doing. Right? So,
but it's also, I mean, this also goes to the fact that, like, you recognize, because of your understanding of game history and the history of this whole industry, what's important, what's not, as you're on the fly finding these things. So you're able to, like, quickly determine, like, this is important.
Right.
You need to set this aside and sort of stuff, because you've got a vast knowledge of, like, key points in the development of the game industry.
Yeah, I think there's some stuff that maybe is real easy and obvious when you're going through, but then there's when you see this tremendous bin, and this is, you know, like the Congo Bongo stuff, right? You're going through arcade flyers and just manuals and everything else, and then that's where you just have to almost like speed like through it and be like, I think this is important. I don't know what this is, and just you create this sort of sub pile that then you sort through a little bit later, and likely you'll miss something, but At least that's how I've gone through it. Where I'm like, hey, I don't think this game came out, or like, I don't remember what this is.
You regularly keep up on like the great mysteries of the game industry too. So right. Like in the back of your mind, you're like, oh, these mysteries have yet to be solved.
Yeah, like on the show floor right now, you know, someone's got a cutout advertisement for Bouncer. I'm like, we all know Bouncer. It's like, oh, that's like the most famous like lost arcade game. So you know, I didn't grab it because it's $40 for a clipping out of a magazine I probably own. But
yeah, I've got it if you need it.
But and I mean, sort of the digital version of that, and I think we've maybe all done this, maybe not you, Mike, but like just have saved eBay searches. Weird keywords.
Yes.
And just check them all the time. And like that has led me down, you know, rabbit holes and paths that I wouldn't even think about.
Not just eBay, even Craigslist. So who we work with, Kevin Wilson, remember that time he found out there's a computer store that his doors were shut in like 87, I think.
Yeah.
And never opened. And it was a computer store that just like sat dormant. Nobody's been in there since. And so they put up on Craigslist that, you know, first come, first serve, take whatever's inside. So we go over there, and there's just a small group of people that turned into a larger group of people. But we go in, and it was a moment in time. There's like the Commodore sign up on the wall that lit up. There's all these machines. There's work tables with stuff still out. But then boxes and boxes of software. I got all the Infocom games and the shrink wrap. I got the Don't Copy That Floppy teacher's kit VHS tape that like I don't think anybody knows this exists, but it's like it has inside it has a workbook for students and all stuff, and it's all crazy stuff. These things that all came from like 88, essentially 87, that you know, that was just because he had a robot search on Craigslist all the time that popped up like, oh, here's some Commodore stuff. And like the stuff we got out of that, we've been mining since. Like there's all kinds of crazy, like, again, the kind of sort of stuff where it's like sent out to dealers of like, here's what we're planning next year. And here's the products that we're going to be releasing, all stuff that like I've been kind of tweeting about in the last year, all the stuff that came out of that.
Yeah. Well, so to Frank's point on eBay save searches, one of the other things that you can do is if you see an auction and then you end up winning it, it's actually asking the seller if they have more. Yeah, because a lot of times they don't realize, like, I've got that whole box. I didn't think the rest of that was worth it. And in some cases, there's things that are even more valuable. Maybe not from a monetary perspective, but definitely from a historical perspective.
Well, I did that with that Nintendo comic.
That's right.
That maybe I shouldn't tell people I have a bunch of, but I'm just going to do it, I guess. a seller
ruin
had,
the market, Frank. Go ahead.
A seller crash had the Nintendo preview comic. So you remember Valiant did Nintendo comics. There was a preview edition. It was only like 8 pages or something. It was really small. And I'm not even sure how it was sent out. I think it was bundled in a comic magazine. And so like most of the copies you see have like ink stains from the rest of the magazine or something. But this was like a flawless copy. And I did a buy it now for $30 and asked him if he had more. And he's like, I've got 15 more. We found them at the printer we just bought. So I have like the first Nintendo comic book ever, you know, in uncirculated condition, which doesn't exist outside of my pile, I think. But like,
well, that's the same thing with like those badges we found with the Nintendo Championship
badges. You got the NWC badge.
I was just at like a flea market, this guy who used to be used to generate and create patches for people just had this little pile of Nintendo World Championship patches from 91, and 90. And so I knew right then, I'm like, well, how much for these? And he's like, $1 each or whatever it was. I'm like, I'll take them all, whatever. But like, this came from the same kind of thing where this guy made these probably for Nintendo, and these were just leftovers in his place. And it's like, there you go.
Or like the guy on the factory line who sold copies of NBA Elite, not knowing that they were.
Just stuff like that. Just
none of this is ephemeral,
up.
But you know,
right.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Well, I guess it's all ephemeral.
Right.
Sure. I don't know if it goes to our definition of ephemera. You know, I might be changing topics here, but like, yeah, we're getting all this stuff.
Yeah.
Right. But like, it's just kind of sitting around right now because archiving things is very difficult.
Yeah.
And that is one of my questions.
Okay.
Which is there a central repository or resource for this material? Like
Frank's brain.
How do you file it, present it, catalog it, share it?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because you were talking to 3 of the 5 founders of a nonprofit that has not been announced yet, where we are the Video Game History Foundation. This is, I've not talked about this at all until now, but I actually stepped down from my day-to-day with Mike to focus on game preservation as a full-time job. So one of the projects that we're going to start with that we're building now is a repository of probably focused mostly on PR and marketing video game material. Because that's not a resource that exists right now, right. And it's just kind of spread around in all these disparate little attempts at things. But that's, you know, I don't want to talk too much about like features or anything because we're still scoping it out. But like, you know, we are in the process of getting all of this ephemera in a place that is, you know, duplicated everywhere, you know, like maybe even mirrored on archive.org or something. But, you know, just getting that lossless material somewhere that's safe. And even if it's like, and this is something we got to figure out, like the three of us, and I should say that the other two members are Simon Carlis, who runs GDC and
he's heavily involved in archive.org.
And Chris Malcinos.
Okay.
Who ran the Smithsonian Games Art of Games exhibit and, you know, is like-minded like us, right?
Exactly.
He's been in the industry for a long time. It has always sort of understood.
And he's he's been pushing for this for a long time. And he finds every way possible to make this stuff happen.
I mean, and you know, he's like stuff. This has been true of all of us, I think. Like, we just kind of inherit stuff because people know us as like that. Oh, like there's this guy.
And he's better than throwing it away.
Right. Yeah. And I think we all recognize that there was a need to have like an organization and like a business card and a logo.
Yeah.
Instead of being that guy I know.
I'm really happy to hear that this is happening because when we did the Retronauts Kickstarter, one of my thoughts was it would be really cool to use this money to create like a nonprofit and, you know, work on video game archiving and preservation. But I also realized like that's not something that we specialize in or have the knowledge to do. So it makes me really happy to hear that the guys who do have that knowledge and expertise and connections and everything are doing this because it's something that desperately needs to be done. That's great.
Well, one thing, you know, Frank and I have had, and actually Mike as well, we had these conversations of we were collecting things because we thought this is important, we need to preserve this. But now video game collecting has become, you know, much more mainstream in terms of activity. So it's like, okay, you know, that copy of Donkey Kong Jr. is going to be preserved by someone. And so a lot of this is not really about ownership.
Right.
It's like, you know, we don't want to have like, oh, are they going to open a museum? No, that's really not the intent. It's really getting it in, doing the preservation in terms of scanning it, archiving it, getting things documented, sharing that information.
Or put in a permanent home.
And then you finding know what I mean? A permanent home for it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there are places that are actual like funded museums that have librarians on staff and people who can preserve paper.
Put them in, you know, like the archival boxes so they don't deteriorate.
Oh, in a way better way than we ever could.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
I mean, we're careful.
I mean, like
but,
you had a flood in your basement.
Yeah,
right?
I had a flood in my basement.
That happens.
Yeah. It's like that act of God sort of thing is like a lot less likely to happen if it's in a proper place.
Yeah. And there's so many wake up calls that I think we've all had. I think the biggest wake up calls have been Ralph Baer dying. It's
like
people are dying now. It's starting,
and we're fortunate in that Ralph Baer was recognized for his contributions and had been interviewed so many times.
And he was, you know, that book of his is so valuable, and like I love the way it's written because it's written from the perspective of like, you know, not in an egotistical way, but Ralph was just like, I recognize that what I did is really important, so while I'm still here, I'm going to tell you everything I remember and show you everything I kept.
Right.
And, like, that's the tone of that book. And that's, like, that's such a wonderful thing to exist.
Wish everybody could do that. Because there's very important people out there who don't have that sort of thought about themselves or what they've worked on. In fact, a lot of them discard what they've worked on in the past.
Well, I think it's his inventor mentality.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like, I document everything.
Yep, exactly.
Because otherwise I can't have a patent for this. Yeah. So, like, we're really fortunate with Ralph. Yeah, but, like, you know, again, he died. Like that's you know, our founding father, you know, in a lot of ways. So it's only going to trickle down from there.
Yeah,
so a lot of this oral history stuff, and you know, the foundation isn't obviously just archiving ephemera and making an archive. Like really, we don't ultimately know where this thing goes. Like year one, this is probably the biggest project, but you know, ultimately, we're sort of hoping that having a nonprofit that is a foundation for preserving video game history will lead to things like, you know, us raising money to give grants to people who are preserving video game history in some way that, you know, fits our standards or whatever. But, you know, like, it's just one of those things that's obviously needed and someone needed to step up. I don't know that I'm, like, you know, the most qualified CEO of a nonprofit, but, like, we'll see.
But also, that's about getting the word out, like, always. Yeah. But,
right.
Like, we've already had a few people reach out who are working on games today, realizing just because of the things you've said on podcasts, that we've all said on podcasts, that I need to get this somewhere. And they're funneling it to us because of that, or asking us how to archive
what
they have, which is amazing to me because we've worked with so many companies where they're like, oh, we want to, like, let's reissue this game. And it's like, great, get us the source code. And they're like, we don't have the source code.
Yeah.
And then we have to track down people who worked on the game who probably stole the source code
Done that,
So we've had to do things like that, but now...
Well, that happened with Grim Fandango, right?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, Grim Fandango remastered was because Tim stole a company computer.
But that stuff had to happen.
Yeah.
And so, like, now that awareness is getting out there, it's awesome that we're getting from people, like, how do I preserve what we've just done? But we've killed ourselves for like, the last 4 years. How do we now preserve it? Because they weren't thinking about that before.
And that's something that, you know, we're also talking about as the foundation, you know, writing up standards and helping companies do that. And, you know, like, I was just actually talking to Matt from Double Fine about this yesterday and, like, how maybe I should come down there and talk about how they're doing it because, like, they're actually among the best in terms of preserving their things. I think partially because they're working on these LucasArts remakes and they were...
Well, they understand the value of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a thing.
But yeah, and that's what we're doing, and you know, it's the beginning of the answer to how do you actually save these things. To me, is don't just be, hey, I know this guy Steve.
Like, I'm gonna show up with a couple banker's boxes and just dig through there. Like, oh,
but
okay.
Like, hey, go to gamehistory.org, which I own. My God, that was available. Gamehistory.org is our website. It doesn't exist right now, but maybe by the time it's there.
But even just putting in people's heads, like,
but
like getting ready to archive something or get rid of something that they should think twice about it.
Right. Right. Like, there's these guys who will just come do it.
Yeah. They can just pick up the phone, like you've done so many times. You guys have, like, somebody's called you and you're just like, you rent a truck and go get whatever you need.
Well,
to
that happened to us with IDOS, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
When Crystal Dynamics was moving offices because they still had the giant office that had IDOS US downstairs. I mean, we got an email that day. It was like, hey, we're about to throw away thousands of games. Do you want to come get them? So, yeah, we just stopped working, got in the U-Haul, and like, but that's so disruptive.
It's very disruptive, but like...
We're like in the middle of iDARB or something.
Yeah, we're trying to ship a game.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Like, we got to preserve somebody else's history.
So, you know, not just having a brand that you can turn to, but like me just like being like, look, I cannot make money for a year and survive, hopefully. But like, I can do this full time. You're not going to disrupt me. So whatever you need, I'll just come do it. So that's, you know, the beginning of our solution to that. And I think we're going to, as this thing grows and becomes public, and as we start having more conversations with people, I think we're going to start to understand what the real needs are.
Exactly.
What we can do. And, you know, we hear all different kinds of things, and obviously we can't do everything.
Yep.
You know, our friend in Seattle thinks that the biggest need right now is have a place where people can put things that you lock away and no one's ever going to see.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, that's kind of...
It's like the seed archive for like video games.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's like a place people can put things anonymously that no one can see for 50 years is like what he thinks we need. And it's like, yeah, maybe, but I don't
know. That's maybe like for, you know, military secrets or something.
But there is a lot of legal things surrounding it. So there's some stuff where it's like they can't even legally let the public see it.
Right.
But they also don't want it to be at risk to be thrown out. So they're looking for a solution.
But maybe our job isn't necessarily to be... To, like, own that space and, like, hire security. But maybe our job is to figure out
a solution
how to clear those hurdles.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, I actually was just on... I was talking with other people about, you know, the SNES PlayStation.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I made a cash offer for it, but at the time, they were probably thinking, are we even allowed to sell this?
Yeah.
Right? Is Sony or Nintendo going to come after us? And I think that's...
Yeah.
You know,
but imagine if they get contacted by a nonprofit called the Video Game History Foundation.
That can assist them in like sorting that out.
Yeah.
Or even acquire the damn thing.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, just last night, I was meeting with folks that were like, we're cleaning out our office. It was an editorial publication. And like, we had dev kits and all this other stuff. And there was the guy in the room who was saying, oh, we need to ship that back to Sony.
Yeah.
And then the other person saying, like, Sony doesn't care about this 10-year-old dev kit, right? Yeah. Yeah. And so you have that push pull, like, okay, what do we do? And then who do we turn to on advice?
Just thinking about Alice at 1UP sending back all those DS cards. It's like, they don't care. Yeah. No, we have to mail these back.
Yeah.
The worst thing that happened during that EGM move, I don't know if I told you about this, was there was a box and I opened it up and it had tapes. And they were like, I don't know, 8-inch tapes, like camcorder tapes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Must have been from old EGM or something. And like, I opened the box and the first one on top just said Game Gear footage. Like, oh, cool. There's probably good stuff in here. And I put it down and it was just gone the next day. Oh. It must have gotten trashed because who would take that home right. but yeah. me?
I'm sure the custodians were like, oh, this is garbage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, office moves. I've been saying this for a while. It's becoming my catchphrase. Our office moves are the biggest threat to video games.
Yeah. Well, that's where I got all that Atari stuff, right? The Tengen Tetris prototypes.
Yeah.
It's two big boxes. Actually, it was at California Extreme yep. where I got those boxes. And we opened it up, and it was basically the licensing group of Atari. And so someone would license an IP, and then they would send them what they had made. So it's like hard driving across like every single platform or you know, Zybots. Yeah. But then in there was like all these prototypes, and we're digging it out. And then we're like, wait, this is the actual development of Tengen Tetris. And you can see the progression across ROMs, right? Awesome. And that was the office move. Atari cleared out, and this was in a closet. And a guy opened the closet, saw these boxes, and thought, oh, Steve might want these.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, you know, and I've always just thought that if you could brand, like Lost Levels was an attempt at just branding, like, this is where unreleased games go. You know, I didn't really take it as far as I could have. But you know what I mean? Like, I've always believed in, like, branding something and being a .org or whatever. Yeah. And that is just way more powerful than I know this guy. So, you know, that's I think, the biggest advantage of this nonprofit.
So this touches a little bit on another question I had, which is the element of money. I mean, just from doing, you know, Game Boy World and Good Intentions and that sort of thing, I've discovered, whoa, you know, trying to get these games and just take photographs of them and their packaging is prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. And it would be really cool for me to have just like a library of complete Game Boy games. But at the same time, I have to, you know, buy my wife health insurance and things like that. So I can't really keep these games. I just kind of like bring them in, document them, send them out, you know, sell them on eBay or whatever. But with this kind of stuff, you can't really do that. There's no churn for...
Well, technically I might be able to, but I feel like even if I scan something, you know, I think that physical archive still has to exist,
right,
to your point.
So that means it's basically a one-way money road.
Yeah.
And that seems... it's a lot for, you know, people to bring, you know, to put on their own shoulders.
Right, but a nonprofit has a lot of tax benefits. You know, like if and when I'm salaried, that's tax free. You know, you know, the company itself isn't taxed the same way as an individual either. So, and also, a company, a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 anyway, and that's still pending because the application's in, which is why we're not like public yet, actually. But a 501c3 can take donations from people that they can write off, so we can start like crowdfunding money that like is, you know, like that people write off, and we can sort of, in theory, if that's where the organization goes, I don't know, if the organization goes toward acquisition, which we haven't talked about too much yet, there's no need to, because we have so much stuff prepared. But like, if we go in that direction, like I think for all of us, you know, that expense can not be our personal expense anymore, right? Or like, you know, the $200 a month I'm paying in storage right now just for video game stuff that like I don't even want to own, you know, that I'm just keeping safe. Like, you know, that I can transfer that to this company then. Like, I'm gonna actually, like, all of my magazines and stuff, I'm giving up possession to this company. I'm donating my stuff. And that's another thing too, right? Yeah. Like we can, once we've sort of figured out all the number crunching and stuff that I don't know if any of us are any good at, but like when we get to the point where we can explain to people, like, yeah, you can sell it or you can write it off and here's the paperwork and we'll do that right now.
Yeah, give them the examples.
Yeah. Like, you know, that might sway people more toward, if they have something, you know, really valuable and they need money, like, it, you know, we might, depending on the person, obviously, right, but like, you know, there's now a place to donate that stuff. And Maybe it's for maybe your write-off's less than you might get on open market. But you know, the point being, like, that could sway people who, you know, have rare material and medical needs. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The, like, the unfortunate thing too that we've learned is, like, you'd think that a lot of these companies have rich histories, would be willing to donate or give some sort of help to preserving their own history.
Yeah.
But even that's hard. It's like it pulling teeth. And you know, a lot of them, especially the larger companies, have what they call their own internal archivist on staff, or whatever. But all that person really does is just hold on to the consumer-facing products.
Yeah.
Not actually any of the ephemera.
Some of them do pretty good. EA's okay.
Yeah, that's, they're pretty good.
Among the companies, EA's pretty good.
But even they are, you know, challenging to get them to support your cause or whatever, because, like, they have their own efforts and that sort of thing.
And they just don't, you know, there haven't been that many opportunities yet where, it, like, they've really lost a lot of revenue because they lost something.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, and right. You know, maybe that would be a wake-up call for somebody.
Yeah. But for a lot of these companies, they see value potentially, and especially with some of the conversations we had recently where they see value in archiving the legal aspects of, you know, who owns what, who's licensed from who, and that sort of thing. Because some of the biggest challenges for them from a business perspective is, like, they might want to reissue a game that they know is going to make a lot of money, but they have now lost the materials for who did the music, do they own the rights to the music.
The source code.
The source code. Source code usually lost, and all that kind of stuff.
But, I mean, we've had, you know, as Digital Eclipse, you and I have had have had situations where, you know, we're ready to, like, go on a game, and they're like, we don't know who owns every part of this.
Exactly.
We can't. Or, like, we don't know that, you know, even, like, some of the packaging and ephemeral material, it's like, we don't know if we own that, and finding that out is way more expensive than whatever people are.
So maybe to a sort of separate point, the actual, like, value or how much this stuff goes for, and it varies wildly, and it just depends on if you find it, right? If you see it. So, you know, for me, first party Nintendo or, you know, training docs or anything like that, if whenever that shows up on eBay, there's enough people with shared searches that it's very likely I'm going to get into a bidding war. But then there's other stuff that just kind of comes out of nowhere. And the description's really bad, and it's really just kind of lucking into what, like, knowing what it is, knowing that that's important. And then you get it for, like, $5 or, like, $10 or something like that, just because of the, you know, the cost of the shipping. And so maybe through this or making people aware that, hey, pieces of paper can be valuable, but it is valuable to only a very small number of people. And, you know, the three of us and some of the other folks we know that, that collect paper, we're buying it because we want to preserve, not because I want something on my shelf, right? Maybe there are people, it's like, you want to lock it away in a vault, or I want to put it, you know, somewhere where no one gets to see it, or we're never, like, I'm not going to scan this because I have the only copy. Like, that's what we're trying to avoid.
I haven't run into that yet. I haven't run into the prototype problem. Where something gets, like, decimated in value because there's a copy
that's dumped.
Like, I don't think anything's gonna happen if we dump your news release.
I mean, I already posted them on Twitter anyway. Like, everybody's seen all of that.
But I think as more people come into it, you could run into that problem, though.
I mean, actually, you know, I have run into that, come to think of it. I have run into that with in the Atari days, Parker Brothers in particular, but I think Atari also. You know, at trade shows, they'd like print up promotional boxes for games that ultimately wouldn't ship, right?
Incredible Hulk.
I've had long arguments about, like, we should scan that Hulk box in high res because that's, like, a valuable piece of ephemera. And the counter argument is, you know, no, then people can reproduce it, and we as collectors will never know the difference. Right. And so we need to never scan this in a way that can be reproduced, because we don't want to go down that rabbit hole where we might lose money. And, and, like, I totally get that mentality, and it's unfortunate, but, like, that could start happening if, you know, as long as we never make a checklist, then people will never collect this stuff.
And there, in fact, at the very beginning of this conversation, the fact that there is no checklist is probably a good thing.
All of those, all the old newsletters for the, like, third-party publishers for the NES, for example. Those used to be worth nothing.
Right.
And then Nintendo Age people on the forum started documenting them, and now you can't get them anymore. You know, because, like, now there's a list.
Right.
Yeah,
like, so, all the issues of, you know, newsletter X, right? And it's like, okay.
Or, like, Warrior World, the NX newsletter, like, forget it. Like, you're never
going to know they had that.
Yeah.
I had, like, the Sunsoft.
Sunsoft Game Time News, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Square had one. FCI had, like, every Taxan had one.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a ton of, like, almost every American third-party publisher for the NES had newsletters. I've not found much of historical interest in them, you know what I mean? But they're still really cool.
Yeah, they're really cool. Flip through, right?
Yeah. So. What else you got?
I mean, that's kind of the bulk of it. And I would like to sort of wind down now. So,
well, actually, really quick, if you don't mind, sorry. The just going back, because one of our biggest projects out the gate with this thing is probably a marketing / PR archive, right? Sort of the importance of that being around, you know, is people who are writing historical retrospectives, doing stuff like you do.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I'm going to be in touch with you guys.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I'm writing about Ishido. Do you have anything about Ishido?
Yes, in fact, at the Library of Congress, I happen to know at the Library of Congress, the copyright submission for Ishido, they have photos of the original prototype board game that was used for the...
Well, DC is only like four hour drive from where I live.
So. No, that archive's in Culpeper, Virginia. There ain't nothing else in Culpeper.
No,
that might actually be closer than DC.
It might be for you, yeah. But like for the stuff you're doing, you know, this archive, like, you know, I think the value of high resolution, clean, color corrected scans is kind of, you know, people don't understand the value of that, but like. For people like you who are creating material with it, or like even me, like I'm creating material right now out of the stuff I got out of a trip to North Dakota to do a story on where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego. But like, you know, having that, like there were pictures of these things online, but like having a nice high res scan of the box, you know, I think that makes the material that people like you and I produce, you know, it makes it look better, which I think gets more eyes on it, which I think promotes the idea of video game history. You know, the more we can do to polish these things, the better. And so, you know, that's a big part of having this archive.
Yeah, I went back and actually redid my first Game Boy, like first year Game Boy book, because I just like took some photos and didn't bother to do any perspective correction. And then I was like, I started doing perspective correction for the next year and was like, oh, that first year stuff looks really shoddy.
Yeah.
Right? So I actually went back and redid it and republished it with a larger size and it looks better.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, again, I don't think it's just like, oh, it looks better. Right. I think you understand that it's more than that. It's like it lends more credibility to this thing we all believe in. It helps spread the word, which in turn helps get eyes on our organization, which in turn helps get things to our organization and preserves video game history.
Well, if you look at like Evan Amos, right, that said he's doing the photograph systems, right, in like professional settings. Every stock photo of a video game system comes from him.
That's
right. Every news article and everything else. Exactly. And then, you know, we hooked him up with the National Video Game Museum where he actually took pictures of their collection, right? So
like the weird rare stuff.
Yeah.
He probably did like the Barbie Game Boy Color prototype
system. Yeah, he spent like 3 days constantly photographing systems, right? And that was his opportunity to do that. And I think actually even NVM guys at first were like, well, will people want to come to the museum
if they can see it
online, right? But then they're realizing, like, no, this is actual promotion.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I can see photos of the USS Enterprise model, but I want to go to the Smithsonian and see, like, that they've restored it and actually be in the presence. There's something,
absolutely,
like, you know, a photo of a Mark Rothko painting is like, oh, there's some colors, but you go and see a Rothko painting and you're like, there's colors.
Yeah, right.
There's a difference.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't think preservation cheapens the value of what's being preserved. I think it just gives greater access to it, allows more people to understand and appreciate it, and doesn't diminish
the original
product itself.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I love when people do is just scanning print ads, right? Sears catalogs or sale flyers and everything. You know, people do those like Radio Shack, like, hey, here's this like 386 SX for $5,000 or something. It would help put things into perspective.
Yeah.
But then, you know, watching the old toy commercials or the game commercials, this is what marketing was.
Yes.
And so one quick thing, you know, in the press release for the NES, the first words are Watch Out, America.
Which Steve is holding.
Yeah,
his hand
I'm sorry, I'm
but.
Holding. Yes, it's Watch Out, America, Space Invaders Beware, Japan's leading manufacturer of electronic games, has just landed here with the NES.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a couple things in there, like Space Invaders reference.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And then the fact that they had to introduce who Nintendo was.
Yeah, Japanese invasion.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Kind of language.
Like, wow, okay,
yeah.
What's going on? Yeah, I think they. Some of the text is like the Japanese believe or whatever in the press release.
Yeah.
Like, wow, that's just a weird way of saying it.
Yeah, totally.
So
yeah, just to wrap up, and you guys can go as crazy with this as you like, but I'm curious to hear what each of you thinks is the most interesting and most precious thing in your collections respectively. And maybe the most interesting tale of acquisition you've had. Like, what's the most extreme length you've gone to find something?
I instantly have an answer for the first half of that. It's not so much an extreme length, though. I think the best thing in my house, and this has been on its way to the strong for like 3 years now. I just haven't mailed it out, is I have the editor's bound archive of a newsletter called, depending on what was in vogue at the time or not, it was either called The Video Game Update or Computer Entertainer. And this is a newsletter started in, I think, 82 or 83, and it ended in 1990. And it was run by these two sisters in L.A. who had a mail-order Atari business. Mm-hmm. And they were like, it was called Video Magic. I don't know if you remember Video Magic.
Yeah, I do.
But yeah, they were, or Video, I think it was, no, it wasn't Video Magic. It was Video
It wasn't
something.
Video Magic?
Video Swapper, video. Maybe? I don't, something like
I know
Video
Magic.
Something. I was thinking Video Magic because an eBay auction just ended.
It was eBay.
It was these two sisters who had a mail order business, and so were always on top of what the new releases were that were coming out and like when they were coming out, and they were sending out catalogs, but like one of these catalogs they added a little bit of editorial material, and then that became a monthly like zine, like a video game zine of that reviewed almost everything, but and there was these two sisters in LA. One of them was like in the music business. I think she worked at Warner Brothers on like their black music label, and she was like working with Prince and stuff as her day job. And at night, she had this video game newsletter. But what's really fascinating about that newsletter, there's a couple things. One is that because of their mail order business, because that was their primary motivation here, they were on top of release dates, and every issue in the back had every game that was coming out for every system and the date that the publisher told them when they called them that month. You know, so like they had a calendar, and so like for games that never happened, like you'll see an announced date, and you'll see it slip, and then disappear. And they'll usually have a story about it disappearing, like we called Nintendo, and Return of Donkey Kong is no longer on the docket. You know, but and that's
do
sort
they
of
actually have something in there about Return of Donkey Kong.
Yes,
or was that a
yeah, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And like there's stuff in there, and but the second even more interesting thing I think is that. Console game industry in America, we all know, crashed like 83, 84-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't really start seeing video game magazines again here until 89.
Mm-hmm.
With GamePro. Maybe it was 88.
Yeah,
I should know that.
Yeah.
Like GamePro
and, Computer Entertainment.
Was that first before GamePro?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I think GamePro was like yeah, I think
right around the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's when you started seeing those again. Like, and that spun off Romantic or something,
right.
Which was a computer. Yeah. But the only people who were reporting on console games between like 85 and 88 were these two sisters. At least that we found. So like that entire dark period, you know, that we actually have like month to month news documentation about this stuff. So like when Nintendo had the AVS, like they were there and they published the photos of the AVS and a write up about what it was and like the launch games and stuff. And like, you know, when Nintendo redesigned it to the NES, they're like, look, that AVS thing's different now. and like release dates for things that we didn't have, like Master System release dates in America don't exist outside of this newsletter, you know?
You really need to get that online.
It's scanned. I just yeah, you're right. That's
something
that
I personally need.
Yeah,
so
it's an ongoing project.
I'm going to start emailing you a lot.
It's an ongoing project, and that's, you know, again, one of the reasons that I needed to just make this full time is
mm-hmm.
I just have a never ending backlog mm-hmm. of like I don't want to just put those out there. Like I want to talk to them a little bit. You know, and like, right. and like, I do have them scanned, but not in a great way, but they're all scanned and in an OCR searchable way, but like, I need to, they're kind of janky. Anyway, that's like a project along right. with a bunch of others, but that is the best. And then as far as most extreme lengths, I'll come back to that. You guys have been thinking about that.
The irony is, like, I don't think I've gone to very many extreme lengths. I don't think I have because, either. Like, usually people just want to give this stuff up because it's taking up space right. or whatever.
Financially, I have, but...
Spending a lot of money on things right. here and there, for sure, but, like, for this flown. Discussion... Yeah,
sure, we've flown. Yeah, yeah. I just went to North Dakota.
Yeah, exactly.
But, okay, actually, yeah, I'll go back to that. Yeah, yeah,
but the... as far as, like, things... to this conversation, there's a couple things that just come to mind. I can't really say which ones are the most like crazy or whatever, but like
favorite, I think
your favorites are here. Like I do have one section in my basement that's just a whole bunch of like floppy disks and hard drives and all stuff that I've accumulated from people who've worked on games in the game industry who are just like, I think there's stuff on here.
Yeah.
And so every so often I go in there and I try backing this stuff up and find out what's on it. And we always find something cool.
Yeah.
Like we found like the Micropolis source code and
all that kind of stuff. Micropolis being the code name for SimCity.
So, yeah, and these things, and then like
Mike so much just has that.
It's just sitting in my basement. Like I didn't even know I had it until just the other day when I was going through stuff. I'm like, well, there it is. And, things. So that's always fun. And then
you
I
might
also,
have the tools that yes. Will Wright lost in his house fire.
In fact, it's even labeled tools. So it's like that could very well be the stuff there. So we've been backing that stuff up and setting up those things for backup. And that's always fun to go to. But then I also have this one thing that I find fascinating because I'm a big fan of Atari in the early arcade days and Atari 2600, but a distributor in the Bay Area just so happened to have the bound Atari marketing department collection of every mention in the United States in a newspaper or any other article about anything Atari.
It's like his scrapbook, basically.
Yeah, essentially for the marketing department. So they had these volumes of it, and he somehow got his hands on that. And then he gave them to me. And so I was going through this, and there's like, you know, small town, whatever, Florida. Yeah, I got to show this to you. Yeah. There's just Xeroxes of every possible mention
of
Atari.
I want to see that because what you start to find in those things are like small, local, game-specific newsletters that there are no mentions of online.
Yeah, so in this case, it's a lot of stories. So it's like, who knows where they come from, right? So it'll talk about like some kid who broke a high score in Asteroids to whatever. And then, you know, even articles about like Atari does, you know, the first whatever ever. And like, if a news article is saying Atari did that first, probably a good chance they did. And now we know.
And I want the Nintendo equivalent so bad.
Wouldn't that be amazing? And but that like, that was eye-opening. I've been through those and just like, I'm always opening up and going like, wow, I didn't know that or whatever. But like, I didn't even know that existed.
There's so much information that just doesn't exist online.
Yeah.
Right. It's only in this old stuff.
And then we could go back and look at the greater context. Because once we know the news, because they wrote in handwriting on these Xeroxes, like every, where it came from, what year, month, or whatever. And it's all there. So it's really good to zero in on.
But I think we all believe that the more that's online, the more other people can start piecing these things together.
Because we can do it all ourselves. Yeah. And so getting it out there.
Someone's
going to
beautiful mind it, right? And be like, wait a minute. Yeah, exactly. And totally realize what the connection
is. It's the only way to like make progress.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, actually, it's, I mean, there's physical things, but the most valuable thing for me has actually been talking to these people that I was reading about in Nintendo Power or who are behind the scenes, right? Like, you know,
like Howard. Howard's really cool.
Yeah, sitting down with Howard Phillips and, you know, we're talking about,
you were the game master.
It's like, oh my God. You tell my 10-year-old self, like, by the way, you know, 30 years from now, you're going to go to
Howard's house.
Yeah, right? We're going to be like sitting there talking about old Nintendo stuff. Or like, you know, just sitting down with Don James and talking about the early days of Nintendo and then the random story coming out where he's like, oh yeah, I'm the voice of the Punch-Out. Like, I'm the announcer. We're like, wait, has that ever been said? Do we know that?
I don't know.
It's like, and then it's like, oh yeah, it was me and the other guy, and we picked the best voice sample. And so it like learning those things are just, you know, like that we talk about oral history. There's just so much there. In terms of like physical pieces, like I love the AVS brochure that I have because I mean, like, that's, you know, what Nintendo was going to step forward with. And then obviously the court case stuff is, I just feel it's weird that I own it. Right, you know, when I'm holding this, it's like, how, like, what confluence of events happened to where this ended up in my collection, right? And like, these were like, people, lawyers holding it up, it's like, this is Nintendo infringing on patents. Like, what? It's crazy. So I think that those are probably my favorites. In terms of, like, greatest lengths, probably financial, is the biggest one. And then, like, traveling to meet some of these people and then actually doing the exchange.
And the greatest length thing real quick for me is just the North Dakota thing, because it's funny, because So there's a game called Where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego, which is kind of an obscure footnote in Carmen Sandiego history, but I've always been very interested in this because Carmen Sandiego is a franchise that we all know. Like, everyone of a certain age knows Carmen Sandiego. Mm-hmm. And there was this weird one-off. It was Where in the World, Where in USA, Where in Europe, Where in North Dakota.
You know, and, yeah, but not everybody knows that North Dakota exists or what it is.
Right. Like, a lot of people, yeah, that's true. And so it's always been, just been this weird footnote on Wikipedia. And there's a little more now than there used to be. But, like, you know, I got in contact with someone who's in education in North Dakota who spearheaded the project because it was obviously, as you might imagine, funded by the state as like a special game for them. Mm. And I had been in contact with this guy, and you know, I had a quick phone interview with him that was like not a very good interview. And you know, he didn't really, I don't know if he just didn't trust me or what, mm-hmm. but like, you know, I had this interview and was like, all right, well, you know, if you're still in contact with these other teachers I'm working on a story, I'd like to talk to them. And like, he just kind of wasn't responding to emails. So this documentary crew, not Area 5, a different one, is doing this series on video game culture stuff. And they wanted to talk to me about Lost Levels. And they wanted to come to my house and like talk about Lost Levels. And I was like, yeah, Lost Levels is cool, but let me tell you about this North Dakota thing. So my extreme length is that I convinced a crew to like fly me out to North Dakota with them and made them arrange to get all the teachers together in a room so that I could talk to them about this game and get the ephemera that they have for it and get that all online.
Yeah. Well, actually,
were you drunk with power at that point?
No, because I felt very depowered immediately when the first day was a 12-hour shoot of me driving and going to locations because it's a friggin' film crew. a lot of stupid, like, walk over here and quip.
This movie, the one in terms of greatest length that all of us have put for, it's the time.
Yes. Yeah,
right. Exactly. I mean, going through, like, how many hours have we spent flipping through pages or bins or...
Just talking about it, I can feel it on my fingers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting paper cuts and we don't even have anything in front of us, right? Scanning, you know, all those hours where you're just trying to get stuff out there.
And I would imagine that you all feel like I used to, which is like, man, if I didn't have to do anything else, I'd get so much done. Yeah. I don't feel like I've made a dent.
Right.
Like, this is all I do now, and it's still just endless. Yeah. And so, yeah, time is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such is the nature of passion projects.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, guys. I think that's more than enough. I appreciate you taking the time out of your California extreme experiences. And just for, you know, Steve bringing in some of this cool stuff for us to look at. Sorry, listeners, that you can't see cool stuff on the podcast. That's just how it goes. But trust me, it's cool.
It'll all be online.
It'll all be online.
So why don't you guys tell us where to find you online and look at your cool stuff?
I don't have a product right now, and I've not even talked about the org before now, but like, depending on your air date, there should be something on gamehistory.org at least explaining in vague
detail. Is that hyphenated or
nope?
One
gamehistory.org.
Yeah,
yeah. I was very surprised it was available, but otherwise, we're all on Twitter.
Yeah,
At Frank Sivaldi.
I'm at Mike J. Micah.
I'm at Stephen P. Lynn.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Twitter's the best.
Yeah,
Twitter's handy.
You'll see us posting. Yeah.
The Tumblr honestly was like a science experiment for what this nonprofit's website will be.
Interesting. That's what, game preservation?
Gamepreservation.tumblr.com,
right? Yeah. Whatever Tumblr is.
Tumblr's not a nonprofit.
Right.
you know, there will be some sort of crowdfunding thing happening probably around when this airs, I'd imagine.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
And then, of course, for Retronauts, you can find Retronauts at retronauts.com, on usgamer.net, on iTunes, on social media as Retronauts, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, we have a Patreon to help support me coming out to California Extreme with an iPhone to talk to people on their hotel rooms, and so on and so forth. So please consider donating $1 or $2 each month. That'd be awesome.
No, give it to us instead.
Give us a little and give them a little. We're here first with our Patreon, so... anyway, yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. Of course, you can find me personally on Twitter as GameSpite. And, of course, check out usgamer.net and GameBoy.world. Anyway, I think that wraps it up for this very cool episode. Again, thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
I'm looking forward to seeing your site launch, and I'm looking forward to scraping the things that you put online for my own purposes.
That is the entire point. It's going to
be amazing. Yep. Yes.
And I really appreciate it. So that wraps it up. We'll be back again next week with a micro episode, and 2 weeks from now with a real episode.